from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Aboriginal people in Australia are better at finding their way around because they use compass directions instead of simply describing things as to the left or right. That's just one of several findings from Stanford psychologist Lyra Boroditsky, who claims language greatly influences our thoughts and perceptions. It's a radical departure from modern linguistic theory. Lyra Boroditsky joins us for the hour ahead as part of our ongoing first-person series after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the Forum program. There are some 7,000 languages in the world, and it seems to our guests that each is a universe unto itself. Does language shape thought? Well, it seems from the research conducted by Stanford professor Lyra Boroditsky, that it does. A cognitive scientist who is an assistant professor of psychology, neuroscience, and symbolic systems at Stanford, Lyra Boroditsky was named Utney Reader's Visionary in 2011, and she joins us as part of our ongoing series. It's a first-person series that features the leaders, innovators, and other compelling characters that make the Bay Area unique. And good to have you here. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's begin by talking about what I would call heterodoxy. I don't want to sound too academic here, but boy, you've taken on Chomsky, really. And I mean, in a sense, you've taken him on because he always felt that language really is shared in terms of deep thought by all languages, universal, and doesn't necessarily separate. And here you are saying something quite different than that. Language shapes thought. It shapes more than that. It shapes the way we focus, the way we remember. So tell us how you began to see that configuration as opposed to what has been almost standard boilerplate for years.
I certainly didn't set out trying to take on Chomsky. That would be a foolish thing to do under the best of circumstances.
We should mention he's the MIT linguist as well as the political commentator, yes.
I started out as a naive psychologist, and my question was simply, does experience shape the way we think? And in psychology, the answer to that is almost always yes, that the things that you do, the things you practice, change the way you think, make you better at doing certain things, make you worse at doing other things. And to me, naively, language didn't seem any different from that. Different languages encourage different practices, and I thought, therefore, it should be the case that depending on which language you speak, you should become more practiced at making certain cognitive distinctions, more practiced at using different cognitive tools. So I didn't come out at this question from a very confrontational point of view, but of course it turns out to be a very controversial question.
In fact, I think you've said publicly that had you known it was so controversial, you might not have waded in these waters after all.
Yes, I think it was definitely a foolhardy thing to do.
Well, but you've gone into new territory, mm-hmm. and it's exciting territory. And let's talk about this territory. And territorially, I'm thinking about, for example, the difference between how one describes a bridge in French and German. Mm-hmm. This is a good bridge to get into your research because the German uses a feminine word, the French use a masculine word, and consequently you've noted that the French talk about the heft and power. One would associate this more on the surface with Germans, but when they use a word like bridge and the French talk about, the Germans talk more about beauty. Mm-hmm. So that kind of distinction can be sort of fanned out into so many ways that language is used.
Yeah, it's true. Languages, of course, make many distinctions beyond just grammatical gender, though grammatical gender is a really fun example to explore because it seems so arbitrary. Why should a bridge or a chair be masculine or feminine?
Or why should something be a fatherland or a motherland? I was thinking about that, you know.
The research on grammatical gender actually started with an observation made by Roman Jakobson, who's a famous Russian linguist. And he noticed that when Russians personify different days of the week, they act like people of different genders. So when they're acting like Monday, they'll act like a man. but when they're acting like Wednesday, they'll act like a woman. And this has to do with the grammatical genders in Russian. Monday is grammatically masculine and Wednesday is grammatically feminine. And so he was the first to propose that the grammatical genders in language actually shape how we perceive these abstract entities or inanimate objects.
So it's a kind of different private world that lives in each of us based on the language we speak. That's really your hypothesis. What happens to people, for example, who are multiple speakers of different languages, who grow up multilingual?
Then you have multiple worlds living inside you. You know, Charlemagne said that to have a second language is to have a second soul. That's obviously a very strong statement about what another language brings to you. But in research, it definitely looks like speakers of people who speak multiple languages take multiple perspectives. And in fact, those perspectives are often active at the same time, even when you're not speaking both languages at the same time.
I always like the old saw that people who speak three languages are trilingual, two are bilingual, and one are American. You also, this research of yours took you pretty far afield. You went and studied Aborigines in Australia, and let's talk about that because that's also pretty interesting stuff. Where when we give somebody directions, we say go left, go right, whatever, and this particular tribe talks about, like, go southeast, go northwest.
Yeah. That's right. There are, in fact, quite a lot of languages around the world that don't rely on words like left and right and instead put everything in some kind of cardinal or absolute directions. Work by linguistic anthropologists like Steve Levinson and John Hovland first really described these languages and showed that people who speak languages like this are incredibly good at staying oriented. And the reason that is, if your language requires you to be able to say, there's an ant on your northwest leg, or pass the cup to the north-northeast a little bit, or in the language that I got a chance to study, the Kuuk-Thaayorre language, the way you say hello, in English we say, how are you? Fine. In Kuuk-Thaayorre you say, which way are you going? And the answer should be something like, north-northwest in the far distance. How about you? So imagine as you're walking around, every person you say hi to, you have to report your heading direction. That's a really strong social invitation to stay oriented, right? If you can't enter into the most basic social interaction without being oriented, you would immediately learn how to orient yourself.
Yeah, Kevin says better than a GPS. He's right about that. You also, a lot of your work has to do with agency. You say... for example, you knock over a cup, you say you broke the cup, but in Spanish, it's the cup broke itself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you literally translate it,
Yeah, so languages differ in the extent to which they distinguish between accidents and intentional events. And English is a little bit strange in that we can talk about accidental events and intentional events using basically the same descriptions. So whether I meant to break the cup or whether it was an accident, it's normal to say, I broke the cup. But in other languages, you have to talk about accidents a different way. So you can't, in some languages, say something like, I broke my arm, unless you're crazy. And you went out looking to break your arm, and then so you succeeded. If it was an accident, as most arm breakings we imagine are, then you would use a different form, like, my arm got broken or my arm broke.
So how does that make us different? I mean, psychologically or mentally or, you know, what can you really quantify here? Because a lot of this gets into some curious empirical types of ways of looking at things, but where do you collate the data and go with it?
With my student, Caitlin Fossey, we've started looking at what people pay attention to in events, depending on how they would describe them. So if you wouldn't describe the person who might be an agent of an event, if you don't say, she broke the cup, but instead you say, the cup broke, do you maybe not remember who did it as well? Or do you maybe not blame the person as much? So we've been doing studies looking at how much people blame, how much they want to punish the people involved, and whether they even remember who was involved. And we find that all of these things differ depending on how you would describe the event. So there are differences in really important consequences like eyewitness memory, blame, punishment, financial liability, the things that we care about in our culture.
Well, and you get into so many... you think about geopolitical discussions that are translated. You think about things that go on in courtrooms, international tribunals that are translated. I mean, this just fans out into so many areas. Again, we're talking Lyra Boroditsky, who is assistant professor of psychology at Stanford, and it's part of our first person series. What about time? There are temporal differences in language mm-hmm. with respect to past, present, and future mm-hmm. that really need to be understood in this larger context of psychology, don't they?
Yeah, time is a fascinating domain. I've spent actually most of my time studying time. The word time is the most frequent noun in English, so we seem to be obsessed with it in our language. And it turns out that time is incredibly flexible both across languages and cultures and across people's minds. The way we conceive of time can really shift depending on context. Some languages will invite their speakers to think of the future as being ahead. So in English, for example, the future is ahead of us and the past is behind us. But in other languages, it's exactly the reverse. So the Aymara, this is work by Rafael Nunez and Yves Switzer, the Aymara reverse the direction of time completely. The future is behind them and the past is in front of them. So when they're talking about the past and the future, they gesture accordingly. When they're talking about the past, they gesture ahead of themselves.
But we often, this makes me think about it, English is spoken in so many different cultures and so many different places, in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and so forth, that you have to wonder about how much culture really shapes thinking, mm-hmm. too. To a great degree, it must work in tandem and in some ways in opposition with what you're talking about, which is language.
Absolutely. I think of language as one part of culture, so I don't think of it as something that's separate from culture. They have a subset-superset relationship. So there's language, that's one part of culture, and then there's all the other stuff that exists outside of language that it's the rest of culture. And we definitely see influences going both ways, that extralinguistic features influence how we talk. Of course, languages are human-invented tools. We create languages to suit our needs. That's why we have so many, because people have different needs around the world. But at the same time, the things that we build into languages tend to stick around and tend to influence many, many generations after. So take a feature like grammatical gender, where we started. No modern French speakers chose to have grammatical gender in their language. They were born into a culture that uses grammatical gender, and you have no choice but to use grammatical gender if you speak a language like that. You just have to learn it. Second language speakers attest to how difficult it is to to learn a language with grammatical gender. But now you're influenced by it. Your thinking, whenever you look at something that can be named by a noun, is influenced by this quirk of grammar that got built in a long, long time ago.
I'm also thinking about just how a lot of your work is revelatory, not only about grammar idiosyncrasies, but about language and its connotative and denotative power, and how it evokes... For example, I think, writing about the Super Bowl back. We're coming up on a Super Bowl this weekend, but back mm-hmm. in 2004, when they had the so-called wardrobe malfunction.
That's right.
But the linguistic sense of that is: did Justin Timberlake rip the costume, or was the costume ripped? And mm-hmm. you have a whole different kind of series of psychological responses to that language. Or another example I found in your work is you talk about a city crime wave is being viewed as a wave of crime or a beast of crime. Mm-hmm. Just these choices of words mm-hmm. can evoke a whole psychology.
Yeah, we've done work looking at how language can evoke knowledge structures. And often, even a single word, if it's the right word, can evoke a whole knowledge structure. So if you say, crime is a beast attacking a city, that makes you think about what it means to contain a beast and what you would do in the case that there was an actual beast.
Not common usage, though, for crime, but it has been used, I guess.
It has been used, and the contrast for us was crime as a virus attacking a city, which is very common. And in fact, now people are designing crime intervention programs specifically based on epidemiological ideas. How do you stop the spread of crime in the same way that you stop the spread of disease? And so what we study is how using even a single word metaphor like that can influence the kinds of solutions people are likely to come up with, the kinds of knowledge structures they build up. And this is, of course, something that politicians know really well, right? Whenever politicians talk about social issues, the discussion is rife with metaphors, and those metaphors all steer you into thinking in a particular way about the social issue.
Talking with Lyra Boroditsky, who was named visionary last year by Utney Reader and is assistant professor of psychology at Stanford. There's work that you did with having people use pins to prick balloons. Talk about that. kind of an unusual experiment, but it has to do with agency again, doesn't it?
That's right. We show people videos of accidental or intentional events. So someone either pricks the balloon intentionally to pop it or accidentally pops the balloon. And we asked speakers of Spanish and English and Japanese to describe these events. We found some really interesting differences in how people describe events. So English speakers would almost always use an agentive expression like "he popped the balloon," where Spanish speakers might say "the balloon popped." we get some wonderful other non-agentive language in Spanish. My favorite example is we have a case where someone is writing with a pencil and the pencil breaks as the person is writing. And the Spanish description was, out of nowhere, a pencil split itself in two. This is the sort of thing that sounds really evasive to English speakers. That's not a normal way of speaking in English. But in Spanish and lots of other languages, that is normal. It would sound too punitive to talk about an accident by saying he broke the pencil. Clearly, it wasn't somebody's fault or intent.
Lyra Boroditsky here with us in studio was known, by the way, in high school as a Red Fury because of her intensity of debating. And red, as many of you know, in Russian is Krasny. It's also beautiful in Czech, but you've done some studies about the shades of blue in Russian and how they contrast to English. And again, talk about that and what it means, really, to see these differences in color.
Mm-hmm. Languages differ a whole lot in how they divide up the world of color. Some languages have only a couple of words for colors. Some languages make lots of distinctions. And languages also differ in where they put boundaries between colors. And so Russian and English differ in that. In English, there's the word blue, but in Russian, there isn't a single word that describes the whole range of colors that English call blue. There's instead a separate term for light blue, golubой, and dark blue, sini. And so Russian speakers are forced by their language to distinguish light shades of blue from dark shades of blue because they have to call them by different names. And we asked whether that makes a difference in how easily Russian speakers are able to distinguish light and dark blues. And we found that there was actually a difference, that the practice of doing so in language, the fact that language forces you to make that distinction, actually makes Russian speakers faster to distinguish these shades of blue.
Russian was your first language?
It was my first language.
But you also speak, Belarusian and Ukrainian? you have a few languages of that region under your belt. Yeah.
I lived in Belarus and spent a lot of time in Ukraine. But mostly I just listened to soccer games in those two languages. That was my main exposure.
You're that big of a soccer fan, huh?
I also speak English.
Yes, we know very fluently, I might add. Somebody once said that there was an evolution told me many years ago, a linguist from Cherny to Krasny because of the changing color of the cherries. It sounded a little bit suspect to me, but...
I haven't heard that.
I didn't put much stock in it, but it's interesting just because what you're talking about also is the way language evolves and its psychological effects on us. It also gets us into some pretty central arguments about nature and nurture.
Of course, yeah. The question of whether language shapes thought is unfortunately positioned right at the center of some of the main controversies in cognitive science and about the nature of mind. To what extent is thinking universal? To what extent is it innate? And to what extent is it culturally based or socially based? Obviously, when you're studying differences and you're focusing on effects of experience, you're focusing very much on the side of culture and the side of nature in nurturing.
Where do you nurture this research of yours? Where do you see it going? It seems like it could go in so many directions.
For me, what's interesting is how we come to think the way we do and how we create the complex meanings that we do. Humans are incredibly smart, and the set of meanings and the knowledge systems that we have exquisitely structured and complex. And I think language and culture and social interaction play an incredibly important part in helping us create these really complex meanings. So understanding the mechanisms through which we're able to invent notions like justice or time travel or imaginary numbers. That's what I've always been interested in. And so looking at the role that language plays in helping us build that knowledge is where I plan to continue going.
And what about looking back? I mean, instead of looking forward for the moment, because I think about English as an Indo-Aryan language and, say, Russian as a Slavic language, mm-hmm. and therefore one could say never the twain shall meet. Mm-hmm. I mean, just all that embedded history.
Languages certainly diversify very quickly. So English wasn't English 300
yeah.
years ago, right? It was very, a very different language. And you mentioned how languages change. Languages change by virtue of human contact and human inventiveness. And the very diversity of human languages is a real testament to how flexible and inventive the human mind is, that we're able to invent not just one way of looking at the world, but 7,000 and many more.
Well, let me open the phone lines. Many of you probably want to weigh in here with your thoughts about language and the differences in language and how they tie into thinking and the way we focus, the way we remember. Different languages certainly invite different cognitive skills. That's sort of the essence of what Professor Boroditsky has come to conclude. And you are welcome to join the program. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, feel free to join us at that toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We'll try to get you through as effectively and efficiently as we can. You also can email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can post any questions or comments you might have on our website, which is kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or do the same with our Facebook page. And we do welcome your involvement in the program and in the discussion, Language Shapes Thought. This is maybe even somewhat revolutionary. Here's Paul from Palo Alto says, "It is a generalization that men use active voice and women use passive voice, but it does appear to be directionally true." Would you agree?
I haven't seen a study that shows that. There are certainly a lot of claims made about gender differences, and not all of them are not all of them hold up to scrutiny. It's definitely the case that every individual uses language in a different way than every other individual. So when we talk about a language like English being a language, every person who speaks English is going to speak English in a way that reflects their own personal history, the things that they've heard, the things that they themselves want to express. So you could say, you know, I speak English, and Sarah Palin also speaks English, but we don't talk the same way.
Well, so she speaks Alaskan English, a very different variety. Here's a listener who asked a question. Actually, it was on my mind. I must. George says, listening intently to your program this morning, question, is the idea that language shapes thought basically a restatement or variant of the Worf Sapir hypothesis? If not, then please explain the distinction. And I was quite honestly thinking about that because, in fact, a little bit about in linguistics what this Sapir-Whorf hypothesis mm-hmm. is. It states that there is a systematic relationship between the grammatical categories of the language a person mm-hmm. speaks and how the person both understands the world and behaves in it. And this pretty controversial hypothesis is named after linguist and anthropologist Edward Sapir and his colleague and student Benjamin Worf.
Mm-hmm. It is definitely a very related idea. The way it's being explored right now in psychology is to make more precise mechanistic psychological models of what it means to say that language shapes thought. So when Sapir and Worf were talking about it, they were coming added from the point of view of linguistics and anthropology, and the psychological mechanisms were lacking in that hypothesis.
Well, they also looked into things like politics and etiquette and, you know, a lot of fascinating stuff there. We're going to a break, though, and when we come back, we'll hear from you and bring you into this conversation. Lyra Boroditsky with us in studio, assistant professor of psychology at Stanford. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we're spending the hour with Lyra Boroditsky, who is assistant professor of psychology at Stanford. And this is part of our first-person series, which features leaders, innovators, and other compelling people who make the Bay Area unique. And our callers do that, so let's go to them, and we'll welcome first Vivek. Good morning. Vivek, are you there? Yeah, hi.
Yes, yes. So thanks for taking my call. My comment, I guess, for the speaker is, if she studied anything about Sanskrit, for example, in the UK, they're doing some research and they're teaching kids to learn Sanskrit, because what they found is that the process of learning Sanskrit and the process of speaking Sanskrit increases their ability to learn other subjects like math and science. And Sanskrit is also a language that has not changed at all in thousands of years. The structure is the same. It's spoken the same way. And even people can understand what was written, let's say, a few thousand years ago.
Thank you for your suggestion. Sanskrit is certainly fascinating. I haven't done any research on it myself, but the topic of trying to understand how the languages we speak shape the way we think is spreading. So it's not just my lab, but many labs around the world are doing this work.
You know who has done a great deal of research on Sanskrit is Jeffrey Mason. I don't know if you recognize that name, but he was to psychoanalysis a little bit what you are to linguistics. I mean, kind of shook up the establishment. You can explore. You've got 7,000 languages to explore.
Sure, and the linguistic diversity in a place like India, for sure, is very exciting.
And so is the diversity of our callers. Mark, you're next. Hi.
Yes, I'm noticing that depth and breadth of choice of words and language is really important, and obviously choice is reflected in things like Jeff Numberg's work. I'm just wondering if you're looking at that at all, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you. Do you know Jeff Numberg's work?
Of course.
Yeah.
Certainly people differ in the size of vocabulary they have and the size of the vocabulary that they use. One thing that we find is that the more distinctions you make in language, the more distinctions you make cognitively. So if we've looked at this mostly in the case where distinctions are obligatory in a language. And so the next question would be is whether you're making a choice to make distinctions, whether that also makes a difference cognitively. Certainly whenever people acquire a new profession or acquire new skills, say you become a doctor, you become a botanist, you have to learn a vocabulary that goes with that profession. And that vocabulary helps you keep straight all the distinctions that come with this new knowledge.
You also did some experiments on how language can help shape what we see. You used some color swatches. Talk about that.
We talked earlier about the work on Russian blues. So that's the work on language and color. There, both in our work and work in other labs, what people are seeing is that language meddles in even pretty basic perceptual decisions. This was a surprise to us. We thought, well, you can decide whether two shades of blue are the same or not without language. Certainly, pigeons can decide whether two shades of blue are the same or not, and they don't speak any language. But it turns out that once you learn a linguistic distinction, it actually goes in and tries to meddle with everything that you're doing. And so that linguistic information becomes active very, very quickly and gets weighed in how you make your decisions.
We did a program a number of years ago on synesthesia, you know, where you experience language through color. Did you do any work with synesthesiacs?
A couple of students of mine by accident ended up doing work on synesthesia. It was actually right as we were doing these experiments on language and color. And we had a participant come in, and she said she'd found the task really difficult because we were showing her colors and she had to at the same time recite some numbers. And she said, oh, the numbers were colored and the colors were colored. And I got them all confused. And we said, what do you mean the numbers were colored? The numbers were black. And it turns out that she was synesthetic. And so these two students that interacted with her ended up working more on synesthesia. And they by accident discovered something very cool. There was for a long time a question of how people might get their synesthetic colors. So why might an A look red to you, whereas a B looks blue? And they found this one woman who claimed she got her colors from a set of refrigerator magnets that she had played with as a child that were colored letters. And they did not believe her because many claims like this existed before in the literature, but none had ever been proven. And she was very upset that they didn't believe her, and she went and found the Fisher-Price refrigerator magnets that her parents still had in the attic and brought them. And since then, it's turned out that there are lots of synesthetes have these Fisher-Price colors as their as their colors.
I didn't wonder if Fisher-Price could do that in their ad campaigns. Corey, join us from Sacramento. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I just recently, as in just a couple of days ago, finished a report in which I referenced a lot of work by our guests and also by John Lucy regarding linguistic relativity. And so it was amazing when I turned on the radio and heard you talking about the Aboriginal research you did, mm-hmm. things like this. So the report that I was doing had to do with essentially linguistic relatively effect on culture.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it had to do with, say, the separatist movement in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
After 300 years or whatever, however long their history is together, they still have this separation of culture. And the idea was it kind of is carried by the language.
You know, for example, if you're talking about Quebec, they even have a separation from French language. I mean,
right.
I can sometimes understand French, but I can't understand it when I'm up in Quebec.
Right. And many cultures, like, for example, I have a lot of friends from other cultures. I travel a lot. I have a lot of friends in America living in these enclaves where they're not really required to learn English. You know, if you live in really deep, like, Chinatown or something like that, you can go a long time without really learning English. And I've learned that a lot of these people, without having anything against America, they consider themselves, whatever country they're from, living in America as opposed to being an American. For, you know, they might have been here 18 years, raised children, but they never bothered to learn much English. And so they consider themselves, for example, Koreans living in America as opposed to Americans. You know what I mean? And I'm wondering if the research has, you know, can say anything about this on a cultural sense instead of a individual sense.
People certainly have a very strong tie between language and identity. We take the languages that we speak to be revealing a fundamental metaphysical truth about reality, and we feel that it's very strongly tied to our very identity, our very soul. So it's no surprise that people hold on, you know, try to hold on to their language try to hold on to the language as a proxy for culture. But of course, the idea of someone coming into America speaking a new language is not new. Certainly, English wasn't the first language spoken in America. It's a conqueror language, right? The pilgrims didn't come and learn Cherokee, for example, or or any of the other languages that were spoken here natively. So this is a part of a normal and long process that's been going on. People come and speak the language that they most identify with.
And Corey, we thank you for the call. Speaking about conquering, here's Maria who wants to know how language changed after the Norman Conquest. Hi, Maria, you're on.
Hi. I'd like to know, one, how it changed the indigenous language there.
Mm-hmm.
And which language has the most prominence now in English? Do we speak French, German, or Scandinavian? And are the words of power and war predominantly French now?
Hmm.
And if you could also recommend any books.
thank you for your question. So the phenomena you're describing of conquest or languages mixing is, again, very, very common. We see this all throughout history, where languages come in contact, all of the languages that come in contact with one another change. English remains a Germanic language. It has the most in common with other languages that are in the Germanic family, though, of course, it has borrowed a whole lot from French and Latin and other Romance languages. You see some really wonderful distinctions, like in English, the words we have separate words for animals and for the meat that come from those animals. So we have cow and beef, or we have pig and pork. And that tells you where those the fact that those words are different actually tells you where the words came from. So the cows were being tended by the Germanic-speaking lower classes, whereas the meat of the cow was being eaten by the French-speaking upper classes.
Now, how do we come to get sweetbreads? Do you know?
So with a lot of these things, you can actually trace the history of how the words in English got to be what they are, because they were being talked about by different people.
Now, this is fascinating stuff. And let me thank the caller. You were talking about listening to soccer games before, and I didn't know you were quite such a soccer fan, but it makes sense because in reading some of your work, I was looking at how Indonesian verbs never changed to express time. So, for example, if you kick a soccer ball, you kick a soccer ball.
Mm-hmm. So in Indonesian, whether you just kicked it or you're about to kick it or you're kicking it right now, the verb always stays the same, whereas, of course, in English, it has to change. And
I think that affected our president, who had to speak Indonesian, I guess, when he lived there?
You know what I think he got from Indonesia? He got his amazing smile. People in Indonesia have that
amazing, big radiant smile. Yeah.
And
it's a good observation. And what about, you also point out in your work that the Koreans are somehow better than English speakers at distinguishing, say, light as opposed to looser fittings?
Oh, yeah. So this is work that started with the work of Melissa Bowerman. And Korean makes a distinction between tight fit and loose fit. So when in English you can say, you can put a cassette into a sleeve, or you can put an apple into a bowl. In both cases, the expression used is put into, but in one case it's a tight fit, and the other case it's a loose fit. English doesn't distinguish that.
Wait a minute.
Does.
Kelly Clarkson singing the Star Spangled Banner at the Super Bowl. I think she'll be a tight fit in her dress. Experiences served us in any way here. I mean, we do use those kind of...
We absolutely do. It's just a question of whether it's required, so whether it's something... It's a distinction that you make every time you talk about something going into something else or onto something else.
Well, let's go on to more callers, and we'll hear next from Emily. Hi, Emily. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering if our guest has done any research on the relationship between language, thought, and depression, and if she's found any practical or therapeutic applications.
There's been some really nice work done by Jamie Pennebaker at the University of Texas in Austin. He's been looking at how people create their own narratives depending on whether they're depressed or not, and all kinds of other states. And he finds some really interesting differences in the way people talk when they're experiencing an episode of depression as opposed to when they're not. I would direct you to his work. There's about 20 years of excellent work on that.
And thank you, Emily, for that question. And here's some of our listeners communicating by email and on our website and Facebook page. Elizabeth from Hillsboro says, this idea of language and thought has always seemed obvious to me. When I first learned the Italian verb to like, which is reflexive, I immediately felt that liking in Italian was a more intimate experience than liking in English. In Italian, one literally says something is pleasing to me. That seems to shove the person and the thing closer together than the English verb to like. And it's almost stereotypically consistent with the idea of the more passionate Italian personality and the somewhat cooler American one, which maintains a little more cultural and linguistic distance between the person and the liked object. That's why the British like to go to Italy, by the way. Here's Elizabeth, who says, hi, I moved to Amsterdam in my early 30s and learned to speak Dutch. I was surprised that certain social concepts that are very important in Holland and have words to describe them do not have corresponding words in English. So these concepts around friendliness in a group or comfort in a social situation, which do not have adequate descriptions in English, are not as valued in our English-speaking society. There were other ways the Dutch had of expressing themselves, which I had to remind myself were not intended to be offensive, but literally translated into English could easily have been taken that way. Mm-hmm. A listener named Donna says, do you see differences in communication in written languages with characters, for example, Asian versus letters, like ideographs and things like that?
Yeah, so there has been some research now, not in my lab, but in other labs, trying to see if there are consequences of using different writing systems. The most rich line of work right now looks just at the basic question of whether your language is written from left to right or right to left. Does that make any difference? It turns out that writing direction organizes a whole lot of our mental activity. And this is kind of a strange finding, but we read from left to right, and as a result, we tend to scan visual scenes from left to right. So if you look at someone looking at a painting, they'll start in the top left corner, and then they'll go down.
And then what about Israelis who read from right to left?
They do it exactly in the opposite direction. Yeah. They do it from right to left. And what's interesting is that even the way we imagine events unfolding in our minds is also affected by writing direction. So if you just ask someone, Bill is giving flowers to Mary. Can you draw that picture? English speakers will draw Bill on the left and Mary on the right. And Arabic speakers will draw Bill on the right and Mary on the left. So the scene in your mind that you imagine also unfolds in a different direction depending on which way the language is written.
Listener writes, German is rather intermediate. It says, I broke myself the arm. I think ability to tell direction is more cultural than linguistics. Aborigines have to be able to tell direction in trackless flat desert, or they can't find a water hole and die. Just within English, I was born in Wyoming, where everyone can tell direction. If you're out in the vast outdoors and can't, you get lost. The person I knew with the worst sense of direction grew up in the grid pattern of Manhattan and never traveled enough to even see the Statue of Liberty.
This is a very intuitive, let me say, this is a very intuitive idea, and a lot of people have this intuition. And if we had started, instead of the Aboriginal example, if we'd started with a Mayan group, which also has absolute directions, or a Balinese group, which lives on an island, our intuitions would be different. So languages like this are spoken in every possible geographical environment all around the world. The only exception being urban areas. So folks who live in urban areas, we don't have a large urban area that speaks a language that uses absolute directions.
There's more jargon in urban areas too, isn't there? So the language takes on its own color and nuances that sometimes is quite different.
Well, you have many different influences coming into an urban area. It's so compact and there's so much contact with people who speak differently.
We'll go to more of your calls and we'll go Palo Alto. Ricky, hi. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question was about the sort of initial contact between cultures. I was just wondering if you can shed some light on the initial relationship between two people who don't speak any of the same words at all, and how perhaps miscommunication at that time might sort of perpetuate itself into the future and either be corrected or not corrected. Just kind of what I'm getting at.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, it's possible to communicate with people who don't speak the same language as you do. I think we've all had an experience of miming things, pointing to things, trying to make ourselves understood in some way. But of course, the communication feels incredibly impoverished compared to what you can do if you really speak the same language as someone. And maybe a lot of listeners have had this experience when you're traveling somewhere else for a while. You might feel like, well, I can sort of communicate with folks here, but then you run across another English speaker. And even if it's a person you would never spend a lot of time talking to in your normal life, just the fact that you can have that fluid conversation feels like such a relief, and you feel this incredible closeness to this person just because you can speak fluently. But to your question of being able to detect miscommunication, I think that's a really tricky one. John Lucey has this idea of a semantic accent. So we all know what a phonological accent sounds like. You continue to mispronounce things when you learn another language. But there's also semantic accent where you don't necessarily realize that there's a subtlety or a distinction that this new language has, or maybe that your old language had, but this new language doesn't. And you continue to speak in a way that has this semantic accent, that you make certain distinctions or you don't make certain distinctions that aren't like what a native speaker would say.
Let me thank the caller. Here's an email question probably you wouldn't have suspected getting. Kobe says, why does she use the masculine form of her surname and not Boroditskaya?
It's an excellent question. It's very confusing when I go back to Russia. When my family immigrated to America, of course, my father's name is Boroditsky. That's the masculine ending. And for my mom and myself, it was Boroditskaya. But in America, the whole family has to have one surname. There's only one name.
It's happened to many Russians.
And so everyone became Boroditsky. It doesn't bother me anymore.
And Arthur, you're on with us. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Oh, yes. How are you doing? This is exciting. I just, before I say anything, Krasny, instead of, you should put more accent on K, so it should be strong.
Krasny.
Krasny.
Yeah, but I anglicized it.
Yeah, I'm sure you're aware of this. I just want to tell you that my greatest regret in life is, not being able to teach my kids the languages, a few languages that I know, and I raised them. It's probably too late. They're about 20s. That was my greatest regret. But my biggest, my main, probably a very difficult question for you is, if you compare the kids who were raised or who were taught different languages compared to monolingual, do they become successful in non-abstract courses, science courses, math, and chemistry, physics, the two groups.
Mm-hmm.
So you see what I'm saying?
Yes. So there's been a lot of work and a lot of controversy about whether being bilingual is good for you or bad for you and what the benefits might be. For a long time, there were actually arguments against teaching Americans any other languages. People would argue that, if you learned French, you would then be exposed to undemocratic ideas, which is, on the face of it, ridiculous, since the French obviously invented democracy, the whole idea of it.
Actually, it goes back to Greece, I think.
Yes.
Contemporary or modern democracy.
But in more recent days, there's been a lot of work looking at cognitive differences between bilingual kids and monolingual kids. And there do seem to be some advantages that you get from being bilingual. It certainly is harder to learn two languages than one, but it does have some benefits down the line. But I think the most important benefit is then you can talk to people who speak that other language. That's such a treat. You mentioned at the beginning of your question that your regret was you didn't teach.
Is that his biggest regret?
Your biggest regret was that you didn't teach your kids the languages that you speak, and you said it's too late now. I don't think it's ever too late. It's certainly the case that it gets harder to learn languages as you get older. But that's a continuous process. The older you get, the harder it is. So the answer to when you should learn a language is always right now. It's going to be harder in 10 years than it is now. So you should just learn or teach the language right now.
And you're listening to Forum. We are talking to Lara Boroditsky. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to more of your calls. We'll go to Madeline next. Madeline, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking the call. Listen, I've just moved back here from almost 10 years living in Australia, and I was really interested, of course, to hear your information about the Aboriginals and everything, and that's a whole other discussion. But when I first got there, I noticed that the choice of words and the construction of sentences was quite a bit more passive, for lack of a better word, gentle. Mm-hmm. So a word like slash to us would be stroke, mm-hmm. and bullet in writing would be dot point. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those disappeared over the course of time that I was there. There is this cultural imperialism that pretty much saturated with American mm-hmm. Popular culture, et cetera, a lot of influence. But, yeah, it to me it revealed, and they wouldn't say things like, how are you doing? It would be, how are you going, mm-hmm. which I think still survives. So it was very interesting, and I sort of saw these peppered all over in the language and how it was reflected in what the people are like. And similar to the reputation of the Aboriginal clans, more evasive, let's say, mm-hmm. Although that isn't, you know, uniformly true among the Aboriginal clans either. But yeah, just how it changed over time from having been, you know, more passive and then moving into more aggressive choices of words and constructions.
Thank you, Madeline. Yeah, you want to say something, Dr. Rose?
Languages change very quickly, and at the same time, often we talk about English taking over, American taking over, and I think people around the world definitely see that. But at the same time, languages also diversify very quickly. So we have these two opposite poles. On the one hand, we have the urge to affiliate and to conform. And on the other hand, we like to make our own tribes and make distinctions from other people. And I think you see both of those forces alive.
Do you think technology is speeding up the changing nature of language?
I think technology is putting more and more people in touch, and so exposing different ways of talking. Mm-hmm. So traditionally, languages change most quickly when two groups of speakers of different languages meet, and so when they have a chance to interact. This could be by conquest or by immigration, and certainly technology makes that physical distance disappear, and so it makes it a lot easier for people to start observing different ways of talking and hearing new things.
And Matt, I think you're on point here. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you for the call. I was wondering if your guest could comment on whether the brain gets stimulated differently when two people speaking different languages are speaking on the same concept. If, like, for example, a chair or commenting on a chair, if the brain lights up differently. I'll take my other question off the air. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for your question. There has been a lot of work looking at how ideas are represented in the brain, the extent to which they're based in different parts of the brain depending on the language. What we do know is that different languages are represented in different places in the brain, especially if you learn them at different times. So if you take someone who learned, say, English as a native language and then Spanish in school, when they're hearing Spanish as opposed to English, different parts of the brain will be involved. What's interesting is if you look at people who grew up speaking both languages at the same time, the representations of the two languages are much more overlapping in the brain. So depending on how integrated your two languages are, they may be more or less integrated in how they're represented in the brain.
There's a listener who writes, "So what a fascinating and thought-provoking discussion. Listening to your conversation, I keep thinking of George Orwell's description in 1984 of the fictional government's efforts to reshape language in order to make it impossible for people to express reactionary thoughts. Has Ms. Boroditsky studied any real-world deliberate attempts to shape thoughts through language? I know that some reforms of the Russian language were carried out after the 1917 revolution, but to what extent was that a deliberate attempt to shape thought according to Marxist ideals?"
Thank you for your question. It's definitely the case that governments or lawyers or business people, all of us who are talking to other people are trying to shape the way other people think. That's the reason that we at any point open our mouths, right, is that we want to put thoughts of a certain sort in another person's mind. There are many, many examples around the world of government-imposed changes in language.
Now, here in the United States, Native Americans weren't allowed to speak their language under many circumstances.
Of course.
And one thinks about, trying to take the Kurds and take their language away in Turkey. I mean, there's so many examples of it. It's a kind of cultural genocide.
But there are even smaller changes where you can, for example, introduce a new word or say that instead of using this word, you should use this set of words instead. So we see lots of these. A silly example would be, don't call them French fries, call them freedom fries.
Yeah. Right. Excellent example. Well, it's been a delight to have you. Thank you. Continue your research and we will continue to follow it and look forward to it.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.